Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
That, ladies and gentlemen, was the voice of Brian Brown, the creator of the Brown Briefly, where every week, as you know, we try to live up to his high standards of hosting a discussion of current events laced with empathy, intelligence, humor, and progressive persuasion. Brian's concept of less is more, more or less, always left us wanting more. So we have friends old and new, returning guests, and a lot of things to cover this week. So I'm so glad you're with us. Let's jump right in to introduce us who are on the show. Vachon Airport Commissioner, Kitchen Remodeler, former Army Intelligence Officer, and recovering back pain patient, Truman O'Brien. Good morning, Truman.
Good morning.
Glad to see you here with us. And to your left, your wingman, airplane co-owner, former Associate Attorney General, and vintage European sports car enthusiast, Craig Bellis. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning, Kevin. How are you today?
Doing well. Good to see everybody. Hey, also this week, we are joined by returning Small Talk guest and Vachon Maury Community Council board member, Jessica Anikar. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning, Kevin. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Good to see you here. And joining you, a new Small Talk guest, James Ricard, and who is an Equity, Social Justice, and Inclusion Committee member. Good morning, James. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you, Kevin. Good morning.
Good morning. And mine is the voice of Kevin Jones of Indivisible Vachon and the Vachon Climate Action Group, looking out my window at the sunny skies before the big freeze sets in. So protect those sensitive plants. Make sure the hose bibs are still in place to make sure your outside faucets don't freeze up. And weather the chilly nights and come back to us next week for another edition of the Brown Briefly. But for now, Truman, how's life treating you?
Well, good. You know, the old back is really squared away finally. And you said kitchen remodeler. Well, I had to take my my dishwasher apart a couple of days ago. And so I'm down on the floor taking it apart, cleaning and putting all the stuff back together. And, you know, I said, gee, this went pretty well. I'm doing great. The next morning I woke up, I could hardly walk. my legs don't fail me now. They were not used to that kind of activity. So I did get it put back together, but I may never walk properly again. So that's my story.
You know, the things that don't take you out make you stronger, too.
Yeah, I'm hoping.
Craig, how is life on Vachon treating you these days?
Well, you know, it's the last week's been somewhat uneventful. Besides working on taxes, joy, and dealing with Xfinity, quote, customer service, end of quote. That took up most of my week. No, it took up a lot of it. But the most significant part of the week was going to the theater and seeing Women Talking. Absolutely marvelous, moving account of activities in Bolivia not that many years ago. It's an extraordinary, extraordinary movie. I'd encourage everybody to go take a look at that. But that's my week.
All right. And Women Talking is the name of the movie. Did I get that right?
It is. It's up for many, I think, Academy Awards.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. All right. Good reference. Hey, let's invite our guests. Jessica, thank you for joining us again on the Brown Briefly. How's your week been?
It's been good. I've been dealing with my own technological difficulties, of course, but I'm feeling positive about the weather changing into spring right now.
Mm-hmm. It's nice to see those day, you know, those evening hours are getting pushed back a little bit, you know, later and later in the day, the darkness arrives. James, thanks for joining us on your inaugural tour of the Brown Briefly in the seat to where you can be heard. How's your life going?
Well, thank you, Kevin. Good morning. It's going great. Actually, I'm looking forward to spring starting to arrive. I like to do a lot of stuff out in the yard. I got the opportunity over the weekend to go to the last day of the Home and Garden Show over in Seattle and got lots of inspiration there for things to put in the ground and grow. Looking forward to that once we get past this freeze.
You know, speaking of the freeze, Susie and I are planning to rotate the hummingbird feeders so that when one gets frozen up, we have another one ready to go. So, you know, lots of considerations for that cold weather.
Kevin, let me tell you something I learned about those feeders, though.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, most of the feeders have a little section in the middle that you don't put fluid in, right? So what I found is if you can take the little hand warmers, the kind that you shake up, you know, that make warm, they will fit perfectly down in that little slot, and it keeps your hummingbird feeder from freezing. So there you go.
That sounds like a tip from a pro hummingbird feeder right
there. There you go. There you go.
Awesome. All right. Well, if you don't know by now, my name's Kevin, and I will say we made some progress towards creating a livable planet last week. You'll recall that we asked our listeners to support a motion before the community council asking our state legislators to support the Vashon Mori Environment and Climate Agenda, which we call just the agenda for short. But that agenda contains legislative outcomes that represent the goals and ambitions of 10 island organizations who are striving to improve our environment and to stabilize the climate. And the motion passed unanimously. So thank you everybody who joined to help make that happen. And so the community council will be sending an email, hopefully shortly, to our state elected officials, letting them know and that they should be supporting them. All right, well, speaking of the community council, the community council, as we know, discussed a land acknowledgement very early in its refounding. And this means it started out as the Vashon Mori Island Community Council, now known as the Vashon Mori Community Council. A land acknowledgement, of course, recognizes that we are living today on ancestral lands that have been occupied prior to our arrival. The council now will include a land acknowledgement statement. That statement was developed through the work that Jessica and James did to basically present a plan and to go forward with this. So I want to say thank you, Jessica, for joining us again on the Brown Briefly. Hey, could you please remind our listeners of your family's presence on Vashon Mori Islands and how you became interested in the Equity, Social Justice, and Inclusion Committee?
Thanks, Kevin. My great-grandfather was a Japanese Baptist missionary, and he traveled in Japan in the early 1900s, and he was offered a job at the Japanese American Baptist Church, and he moved to the island and worked with supporting the Japanese immigrants here. My grandmother lost her childhood friend that lived down the street from her on Kingsbury to an internment camp, and she never returned. And that began her fight for social justice. She worked as a school teacher here on the island for 28 years. Her students called her Mamacita, and she openly fought for social justice and racial justice within our community. So that has inspired me to continue on with her example of community service.
That is a very inspiring story, and thank you so much. I believe, Jessica, you are fourth generation of Vashon Mori Islander, is that right?
My children are fifth generation here, yeah.
Wow.
Ooh, awesome. All right, well, thanks again for being with us. Welcome, James, to your first appearance on the Briefly. Could you let our listeners know a little bit about yourself and your journey to our islands?
I'd be delighted. Actually, I'm a retired Army Medical Service Corps officer. My last assignment was as the chief of staff at Madigan Army Medical Center. Part of that, I'd been at the Pentagon, and I had been stationed in Europe twice. And folks told me when I was at the Pentagon, if you want to live somewhere in America that is anything like Germany, you should get out to the Pacific Northwest. And we moved here in 96. As my wife said, she watered the taproot under the house, and we were not ever leaving the Northwest again. In fact, I was going to be reassigned to the high desert in California in a training facility. And my wife said, I hope I get to see you on weekends. So I retired in 2000. Then I moved over to MultiCare Health System, where I worked for 15 years. And then after retiring from them, I've been doing consulting and organizational design and development. And I'm currently semi-retired and work as a leadership coach, primarily working with physicians in executive leadership positions in various health systems around the country. Wow. With our children out of the house, my wife and I moved here a little over 3 years ago, so we're very new to the island, frankly, to find peace and community. The pandemic clearly slowed our ability to get involved in the community, but peace we've found. And it may sound trite, but this is our forever home, and we're really digging in now to getting more involved in the community.
I'm curious, whereabouts in Germany?
First tour, I was in Mannheim, mm-hmm. right outside of Heidelberg.
Right.
And the second tour, I was up near the Wiesbaden Air Base.
Oh, okay. Reason I ask, I was in Kaiserslautern for a little over 18 months. So.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my first tour, I was a infantry officer and spent a lot of time up on the border with a scout platoon when there was a wall.
Yeah, exactly.
A literal wall, not a figurative one.
Yeah. Interesting.
All right. Well, we could definitely delve into stories about Germany and spending time there. But welcome, James, to Vashon. I hope you and Kathy are watering the taproot and it reaches the aquifer. I'll just say a little known fact is that when you and Kathy and I had a first chance to meet on the island, that we discovered that you and Kathy and I had moved to Vashon from the same neighborhood. We lived different times in houses that are literally like within two blocks of each other.
Oh, my gosh.
Indeed, we did.
Small world, in quotes. All right. So the two of you led the Equity, Social Justice, and Inclusion Committee work to propose a community council land acknowledgement. So tell us how you approached that work and what did you learn along the way?
Well, maybe I can talk about the process, maybe, and Jessica could cover the learnings. Our primary focus was to gather input and insights from the community. We were very fortunate to have a tremendous amount of research and work that had been done by a fellow committee member, Allison Trundle, who just gave us a trove of information to get started. We held four open sessions and invited community members to join us in developing the land acknowledgement proposal for the council. The first three of those sessions were held last fall. They were all by Zoom with the pandemic still going. And then the fourth we held last month in January, and we did that one in person. With the diverse input we gathered, we developed five separate statements for the council's use. And I'll turn it over to Jessica to tell you what we learned.
Thanks, James. So we really tried to interweave all of the perspectives that we received. We received a lot of feedback about bringing the statement to life with actions, of course. And we tried to create statements that really express the diverse opinions within our community. It was a wonderful, wonderful process. We had a presentation from Bruce Hallman on the Indigenous history here. And I found people to be really open and caring, and I really enjoyed working with James through this and getting an idea of our community and the actions that we want to take.
You know, we heard, I agree in terms of hearing the feedback about the process. People like Raina Holtz, who's been very much involved with the Heritage Museum, of which Bruce is the president, outreaching to the Puyallup tribe. And so, yeah, I definitely was really impressed with the folks who stepped forward to contribute their thoughts to the work that you did. So, hey, your land acknowledgement statements are now approved by the Community Council Board. That happened earlier this month. And I was fortunate to be at the meeting where they were first read at the Vashon Mori Community Council meeting last week. Have you heard any feedback from that, or what was your perspective on the fact that we're now on the path to reading land acknowledgments?
I haven't heard any feedback from the community on the path of reading land acknowledgments, but I have shared some of my stories in working with tribal members and being adopted into a Lakota family. And throughout the process, we're looking for gratitude. And what I'm really grateful for is our community taking these steps to feel grateful. And I, of course, always welcome any feedback.
You know, that kind of goes into this notion of bringing the land acknowledgement to life. I'm curious how you both see that, and how do you expect we can accomplish that?
Kevin, in my opinion, and actually that of the vast majority of the people who provided input, a land acknowledgement statement is just a first small step in providing restitution to Indigenous peoples. There was a lot of talk about the harms done in the past, and frankly, harm being done currently today. I feel that each one of us can actively bring the statement to life. Stewardship of the environment, the land, the air, water, plants, animals, is one of the cornerstones of their way of life. And to that end, we can all take individual steps to help shepherd the environment. For instance, cleaning the land and water of litter and harmful chemicals. A small step at the individual level collectively can make a very big impact. There are also many agencies, initiatives, and tribes to which you can donate if that is how you would like to contribute to this effort. Some of these include increasing educational opportunities, expanding housing, and assisting efforts to address emergencies. There will certainly be other efforts that may take a larger commitment of people and other resources. Ideas and proposals of that nature can, I think, after proper research, in some cases vetting, and even necessarily voting, can be undertaken by various larger philanthropic organizations, or perhaps even, if it's appropriate and is voted on by the council, might be undertaken by the community council.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Yeah, Jessica, I don't know if you had anything to add to that.
No, I just wanted to say thank you, James. You know, I've been reading articles regarding the Supreme Court case on child adoption, and some of many of the Indian news and other resources, including a resource from Harvard, has really highlighted how important it is for all of us to defend the legal sovereignty and the rights. So I feel that, you know, this is really important work as we create more educational opportunities and actions that we can take.
Yeah, Craig.
I think it's critically important as well. And I'm a big advocate of your activities and work in this regard. And I hesitate to bring up a potential negative in the process that you had, the four meetings, et cetera, et cetera. As you know, across the nation, there are parts of the country and certain representatives or individuals who are seeking office who are condemning what they call critical race theory. And I was wondering whether or not you've run into any of that on the island in the process of putting together this land acknowledgement. And if the answer is no, great.
We did not actually discuss critical race theory at any point in our meetings. We did discuss and share stories of our own experiences, and in sort of our own varied understandings, and we did discuss the efforts that the Puyallup tribe has really taken for decades now to buy up existing shorelines and to fight for making sure that our water systems aren't polluted. And because of their careful planning, they took actions to help us with climate change well before we were taking actions. And so those are reasons that we as a community can feel grateful and hopefully find ways to, you know, continue partnerships.
Yeah, Craig, I would just add, I struggle with this whole dichotomy of opinion around critical race theory. And as it relates to a land acknowledgement statement, I have observed, and we didn't see it, as Jessica said, in our specific meetings, but I have observed that some people are offended in the present day thinking that a land acknowledgement statement is castigating them for what they're doing today, or that they should feel guilt for what their forefathers 150, 250 years ago did. And I think that's a mistake, frankly. I think in illuminating what happened centuries ago can be used as a powerful instrument of education for us in the present day so we don't repeat it, mm-hmm. that we learn from it. It's not that I'm personally guilty because someone stole land from indigenous people a century ago, but I can do everything in my power today to make sure we don't repeat that and other harms that happen today. Don't know if that's really answering your question.
No, it does answer my question, because I don't doubt there are individuals, even on the magical island of Vashon, that may have unspoken feelings in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Well, and to your point of raising it when you said you were at risk of raising a negative, I appreciate it that you raised a negative. And if there are people with those unspoken feelings, I think together we can lift everybody up if we can address them. Mm-hmm. Get them out in the open and let's talk about it.
Yep. Good.
Mm-hmm. My only yes. question is, what are you attempting to accomplish with the land acknowledgement statement? I mean, what is the impetus for doing that? What are you trying to do? Anyone?
I believe that building awareness is a really important part of our community, in the way that we care for each other. And, you know, a big part of why I took on the land acknowledgement was my own gratitude for the support that members of the Indigenous tribes have offered me and my children. And in that gratitude, I was seeking to help to build awareness and acknowledgement of their bravery and their honor, and their cultural traditions, which are alive in our community, in many, many ways. So that was my goal for doing this.
The one thing that you said, James, that I really appreciate is the not repeating. And I'm looking at Russia and Ukraine right now. I mean, what is the difference between what Russia is doing to Ukraine and what's happened in the past? I mean, it seems to me like that's two of the same thing. And we are now supporting Ukraine, obviously, which, you know, because we think like they think. What's the difference? And is this land acknowledgement going to do anything toward changing that mindset of the Russians, for example?
I think the difference, if I understand your question, I think the difference between the efforts of the country, our country today, to support Ukraine, Ukraine is a very important partner for us, and it's just become so visible today. Through the news, through technology, we can see what's happening on the battlefield and what's happening in the towns and villages of Ukraine, and it makes it much more personal for me. That's my experience.
I agree.
And I become very upset about it. You should ask my wife. what happened here centuries ago to the indigenous people is nowhere near as visible. It's practically invisible unless you actively go out and look for it. You don't hear about it in the press. You don't see it on TV. Mm-hmm. It's not really on social media. And I think that's a big difference. And so the land acknowledgement statement, in a very small way, but it's a first step, is to raise awareness and to raise consciousness of what happened. Going back to what I said earlier, primarily so we don't repeat those same mistakes going forward. I don't think I'm answering the part of your question about Russia, but perhaps I'm struggling with that too much.
So one thing that I would like to contribute, I don't know, Truman, if you had another question, but
no,
give you. Okay. Full disclosure, I am the chair of the Equity, Social Justice, Inclusion Committee. So I have definitely had the opportunity to have a unique insight, I would say, into the work that Jessica and James have done. And one of the things that we've discussed as a committee is that our committee is self-selected. We're self-nominated. The members of our committee are those who were in the room at the time when the motion to create the committee was passed and those who put their hand up. We know that we're not representative of our total community here on Vashon Mori Islands. And in one sense, a land acknowledgement can be a reminder that we're not all at the table when the community council does its work. And we need to think more broadly beyond just those of us who were there about the actions that the community council is taking and that awareness that we need to be cogent and cognizant. As Jessica said, awareness. We need to be aware that we need to think beyond our own situation and recognize that others live here too. And until we can increase the engagement with folks on the council, maybe a land acknowledgement is just one small step to raise our awareness around that point. So with that, maybe we can go to asking each of you, Jessica and James, to read one of the five land acknowledgement statements that you created for the use for the council.
Do you like to start, Jessica, or do you want me to go first?
I will go ahead. Thanks, James. We acknowledge and honor the tribes of Washington State as political entities. We commit to respecting the laws of treaties and sovereignty under the United States Constitution, Article 6. We commit to taking actions of reconciliation, working with tribes to identify ways to steward the land, restore habitats, and fostering practices that will benefit future generations.
Awesome. Thanks, Jessica. Our second one that was in the proposal is as follows. Please join me in acknowledging the Coast Salish people. The land we occupy today is their ancestral land. For thousands of years, they lived on it, stewarding its resources with care and wisdom. Today, with gratitude, we acknowledge them and their elders, past, present, and emerging, and recognize that this land remains a vital part of their cultural sovereignty.
All right. Thank you, James. So I do hearken back to the beginning of the show, Craig, where you talked about the movie that you had seen over the last week and some of the issues that were exposed there. I'll have to let our listeners know if they haven't seen the movie 13th. It's about the 13th Amendment. It does not address indigenous, but it does basically go into a history of the Black community in America. If you have not seen the 13th movie, then it's well worth taking a look at. It helps me understand some of my colleagues who talk so passionately about repairing damage that's been done. So I think that we can all take steps forward. As James said, I agree, not to impose guilt, but to create and raise awareness, as Jessica said, that there are things we can do to live more in harmony in a community with those all around us. So thanks for all that. I don't know if there's any closing questions or comments that folks had for Jessica and James on the land acknowledgement. Craig.
Just basically wanted to thank you for all the work that you've done, Jessica and James. You know, some people think that because the community council is not a government entity, it doesn't have any power, when in fact it has tremendous power as a representative of the Vashon, Maury Island, and is a very important organization, one that's near and dear to me, having been president for 6 years and years gone by. So I'm thrilled with the work you're doing, and thank you very much.
Right. Likewise. Thank you so much. Hey, just for folks who would like to get involved in that work, you can get in touch with me as the chair of the committee. You can email me, kevin@indivisiblevashon.org. And I'll look forward to an email if you want to be part of the work that we have just been discussing here with Jessica and James, my colleagues on the committee, amongst many others who are doing very good work, in my opinion. All right. So Jessica and James, you are absolutely welcome to stay. I know that you have busy lives, so I understand completely if you want to step off the stage. But we'll have more conversations about local events, national and international events. So you can welcome to join in if you'd like. And if you just want to stay in and put your ear in and not your voice, that's cool too. All right. But thanks again so much for being here. All right. Hey, so focusing on injustices, real talk today, Voice of Vashon, 3 p.m. Mass incarceration is the topic. It affects millions of people in this country. Many are young Black men whose lives are marked by unfortunate choices they made as adolescents, which too frequently result in inordinately long prison sentences. So current briefly emeritus Susan McCabe will talk with three members of the Black Prisoners Caucus, Grady Mitchell, Willie Nobles, and Cyril Walrond, who all have experienced and survived long prison sentences. They've managed to return to society and now working to help others inside the prison system. So today at 3 p.m. to hear what it's really like to live in prison, how to survive physically, mentally, and emotionally, and what it takes to grow in those circumstances. So Craig, in this lead up to Susan's Real Talk today at 3 p.m., I'm curious, as a former assistant attorney general, what are your views of this inordinately long prison sentences served by young Black men whose entire lives are marked by unfortunate choices they made as adolescents?
This is a subject that is very important to me and has been in the past as well. When you say inordinate, the research on this has made it clear that Black men are serving longer terms for exactly the same crimes. We're not talking about counting the people in jail who have long terms and those who have short terms. We're talking about people who have exactly the same or you know, are convicted of the same crimes or pled guilty of the same crimes. Black individuals are serving longer terms. And as a matter of fact, Black older men are serving the longest terms. We're turning prisons into retirement homes, which is unfortunate to say the least. What's the future? You know, that's the whole issue of incarceration. Is it punishment? Is it rehabilitation? Is it what is it? And it's like pushing a big rock up a hill. When I was at the University of California, Santa Cruz, I did work at Soledad Prison. And witnessed the conditions there and the circumstances under which people were incarcerated. And I find that it really is, it's a generational issue. It's a more than a generational issue. It's a It's an issue that's been going on for hundreds of years. This may seem a little far-fetched, but my senior thesis, I was a psychology major, was whether or not the theories of moral development in children, Colbert's theories of moral development in children, were mirrored in society and the way we treat and punish individuals who've been convicted. The first stages have to do with consequences. If you do something and you cause a bad consequence, you get punished. Mm-hmm. Later theories of moral development have to do with your own personal code of responsibility. And society keeps harmonic motion, waving back and forth between those two. They go back and forth. I mean, you've got Texas legislators who say in murder cases, the death penalty should be administered in the same fashion that the individual committed the crime, which is most people's minds pretty barbaric, to say the least. But, those are the kinds of issues that you have to keep pushing back on. And I think that the efforts that are being made now to review long sentences, because people do change in prison, sometimes for the worse, but oftentimes for the better. And it's not just automatic that somebody gets a 15-year or 20-year sentence and they're never looked at again.
Come on, Donald. Donald wants to come back and do mass executions.
Well, Donald set a horrible example every time he'd get up in a speech and say, back in the old days, we'd carry those guys out on a stretcher.
Yeah. Yeah.
That was the way you dealt with, it's that authoritative personality versus trying to understand fault and guilt and culpability and rehabilitation. Yeah. Some would say it's the difference between a paternal and a maternal approach.
Yeah.
We've got a long way to evolve, a long way.
Well, any other comments? I certainly jump in. I will say that, James, go ahead.
Well, thank you. I do not have any history in the law, but I was also a psychology major. But first, I'd like to say that making unfortunate choices is not limited to people of color. If we just look at the makeup of the American population, the majority of which is white, that implies that young white men make more unfortunate choices than people of color. However, the current judicial system, which is made up of primarily white men, doesn't judge them as harshly as it does young people of color, as Greg was saying. Same exact crime, very disproportionate sentences. For myself, I don't think it's an apparent inequity. I believe it's a very real one. And just recently read an article in the New York Times about the impact of that inequity. The data is just now really starting to come out officially on deaths within prison during the pandemic. And across the nation, deaths rose by nearly 50% in prison. And in 6 states, they doubled. But if you look at the inequities in the lengths of incarceration of young people of color or old, to Craig's point, they are disproportionately impacted. So we had more deaths among people of color in prison than people who aren't of color. I think mass incarceration is a very real threat to the future of our nation. And it's going to take a tremendous amount of effort, as Craig was saying, and I think frankly will. By each of us individually and our elected leaders to change our mindset regarding who, what, and how we punish people. We're a bit of we're fairly unique on this planet in how we treat people in jail or how we choose to put them in jail and what is the purpose of jail.
Just to that point, James, so those who've seen the movie 13th, know that it starts out by citing some statistics. It says that 5% of the U.S., we have 5% of the global population here in the United States. We are only 5% of the entire world's population. we incarcerate 25% of the world's people who are in jail. So 5% of the population imprisons 25% of the total global population. One in 17 white people are in jail. One of every three people of color are in jail, if wow. you look at the numbers.
Wow.
So startling statistics. I can tell you, I won't go into the details of some of my misspent youth, but I'll tell you one story. Susie and I were headed up to help my mother, I think, do some repairs on her house. And as we got off the ferry on the south end, we drove past Ruston. We would normally drop down and go along the water, and the road was closed. It was some kind of a running event. And we were in a hurry, and I was frustrated, and we stopped. There were two police officers there who were managing the traffic and directing people. And so I saw, oh, the road's closed. We had to back up. And so then I thought, well, I should go ask them, you know, exactly how should I get around this? I need to get to my destination. So I went, you know, after backing up, I drove forward again to talk to the police officer. There were two of them there. And one of them put their hand on their sidearm in fear that I was somehow an angry person that was going to do them harm with my vehicle. And that opened my eyes, and I realized that if I had not been my color, I could have had a very different experience there. So I agree totally, James. I think we need to recognize that, you know, we have many of us carry a privilege that has allowed us to avoid that incarceration trap that the 13th goes into in such amount of detail. Okay, Truman.
Yeah, I just wanted to throw in real quick. You were talking about Susan's show at 3 o'clock. If you want to get a preview, you can go to voiceofashon.org, select shows, and select Real Talk, and work your way down. There is she did a show on mass incarceration and Black Lives Matter, and I don't see the date on it, but it was quite some time ago, and I believe it's some of these same folks. So if you want to get a preview, I would recommend you go to that and hear that first. You might get a little more insight into the problem.
All right. Fantastic. Show worth listening to. Okay. Why don't we move on to Fox News in trouble? I put news now in air quotes. If you didn't
yes,
see
thank
that.
You.
But so briefly, just to get us all on the same page, Dominion Voting Systems is accusing Fox of defamation, alleging that Fox knowingly aired false information about the company. Newly released documents indicate that Fox executives and hosts knew their statements were false, but continued to broadcast the falsehoods to protect their stock price. Hey, Craig, maybe we'll start with you again. Does Dominion have a case? What do you think?
Yes.
Yeah, in a word.
Yeah, yeah. Dominion and Smartmatic both have excellent cases against Fox News. Dominion's for $1.6 billion and Smartmatic's for $2.7 billion, which makes up about one-fifth of all of Fox's market cap. So if such a judgment or such judgments were entered, they would have a significant effect on Fox. But it's interesting. In order to prove defamation against a public figure, which is what the judge says, a Smartmatic and Dominion have become because they're so much in the news. You've got to prove that the wrongdoer acted with malice, and malice is one of those weird legal terms that has nothing to do with malice. It has to do with knowledge or reckless disregard for the truth. And from what I've seen, there's clear evidence of that. So I think they have an excellent case. The only problem that they're going to run into is proving that they actually suffered those kinds of damages. That Dominion or Smartmatic actually suffered 1.7 or 2. Whatever it is, billion dollars in damages. So my prediction, if I can make one, you never know what a jury and a judge are going to do, but my prediction is that that Fox will be held liable, but the damage award will not be as high as they're asking.
Mm-hmm. You know, the one thing that I always try to look at things from both sides, you know, always.
You don't. No, you don't.
Yes, I do.
No, you
yes,
don't.
Yes, I do. I have an opinion. I have an opinion.
What about that time?
That one time. No, but I do. And I try my best to pay attention to what, you know, what Fox quote news is saying. But I just don't get it. I mean, how can people believe some of this garbage that these people are saying? I mean, it's just so obvious. And well,
that was the argument they made. They have made that argument in other cases. What we said wasn't true, but nobody in their right mind would believe it.
Yeah, exactly.
And in fact, you've got millions of
millions
people
who are believing it. So, it's just it's amazing to me. And along that same line, I want to throw this out to you. The fact that that they were given all of the tapes from the January 6th, I just cannot even begin to imagine what they're going to put together out of that. And the people who listen to them are going to hear only that thing that they put out. And how in the world? I just don't get it. I don't understand how.
People looking for something to, you know, reconfirm their beliefs.
I guess
it's the old deal. What is it? It's a lot easier to defraud somebody than it is to convince them that they've been defrauded.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, that kind of gets into, and I'm glad that we have a couple of psychology folks here who can maybe give us some insight into that. You know, this causes me to wonder about the disinformation marketplace, if you will. Right. So we've already heard some of this, if you're following the stories, that, Fox was concerned about its stock price, and they were concerned that some of its listeners, since they didn't hear the disinformation they so cherished, they would go to another network where they could find it or maybe go online. So Newsmax, One America Network, in case, you know, you're shopping around for a disinformation network. Those are a couple of them that I believe. So what's going on here? Is this just a situation where corporate entities are, you know, trying to deliver what their customers want? And is this a situation now where there's such a disinformation market that you can't address it by chastising corporate entities, right? It's just part of the culture. Where are we at?
You know, I don't like to think of myself as a cynic. But you can't help but become somewhat cynical when you ask these leading questions, Kevin. You do suggest the answer. There's no question. There's no question about that. But the just like some politicians have nothing in mind in terms of, you know, for the public good, but are only interested in maintaining power or gaining power. There are many corporations that have really nothing to do with what they say they're doing or what they represent themselves as doing. They're more interested in ratings and making money. So, that sounds cynical, but I've seen it in my short life of 73 years. I have seen it time and time again. So,
Well, there is a principle, I can't remember what it is, but, you know, when we deal with Puget Sound Energy and try to influence them to change their product mix, you know, they talk about they're required to maximize their profits as a corporation. There's sort of,
that's what corporations do. I mean, that's what you're supposed to maximize the profit for your investors. You know, I mean, I can't fault somebody for trying to.
But not at all costs.
Yeah.
You can't commit crimes.
Well, they're well.
You can't defame people in the process.
Yeah, James, what are your thoughts?
Thanks. Certainly, making a buck is what a lot of these corporations are for. As a quick aside, I'd even note that not-for-profits are focused on making a buck, and they get a lot of protection. And, you know, you spend $20 million on a Super Bowl ad and you're a not-for-profit healthcare system, that doesn't work for me. But I think another thing driving this disinformation trend, if you personalize it and think about how hard is it for you to change something in your own life? I want to stop smoking. I want to lose weight, whatever it is. How easy is that? It's extremely difficult. Now add a layer of fear. And I think for decades, primarily the Republican Party has driven fear into our culture. And we were talking about it briefly in incarceration. And I think fear shows up here, and then people find a story that supports their way of looking at the world, and that is reinforced by fear. And so the disinformation networks jump on that, and fear sells. Fear sells mightily. And so then how easy is it for someone who has swallowed all of that, how easy is it for them to change when they keep get reinforced with the way they're thinking is the right way to think? They have no or very little motivation to change their way of thinking. They don't get objective about it and look at what's going on in the country. I mean, what did Donald do that really helps the country?
It's about as easy. We got Captain Joe sitting in the studio with us right now. It's about as easy as stopping or changing course quickly on a huge container ship that's running at full speed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And no analogy to the ship of state, I assume.
Okay. Good point. Hey, James, I'm glad you brought that point up. You know, I don't recall exactly what I was reading, but it was about sort of a theory of human change. And the article pointed out that those with a lot of intellectual capacity and a lot of resources are those who can be the hardest to change their position. And the fundamental motivator that was described in the article is our wanting to be right and our desire to justify the actions we've taken. And so those who have a lot of resources and a lot of intellect will go to the much greater ends to find the data that will justify their position that they've taken in the past. And they can be some of the hardest minds to change. So,
Or as my wife would say, I just make the facts up.
Well, that is thematic of what we're talking about, I think.
You know, one of the things, watching MSNBC, something that struck me just a year ago or more, they were talking about tear gassing some of the folks at the border, mm-hmm. And that we had tear gassed them. And if you watch Fox News or if you watch... I'm sorry, I say Fox News. Fox, you would see the folks on the other side throwing rocks and everything at the people with the tear gas. But if you watch the MSN, you don't see the guys throwing rocks. You only see him firing the tear gas. And so that one for me really brought out the bias that you're going to get in any news. I don't care if it's MSN or Fox or whatever, there's going to be a bias there because they're going to show you one part of it. And that's one of the things that worries me about this, all of these tapes being given to Fox because of what they're going to try and convince folks of. Yes. You can make it look however you want it to look, I think.
Yeah, I will say that for those who want to dig into this a little deeper, go to the internet and look up media bias figure, media bias table or something like that. It basically, you'll be able to find multiple news agencies and where they land on a spectrum of right-leaning, left-leaning, and in the middle. That. So yeah, it's pretty insightful, and that can maybe help you with your appetite for information. Let's see, we shouldn't pass up the opportunity. We have two veterans with us today talk about international events in Ukraine and Russia, where today both President Putin and President Biden are expected to make additional public comments. One-year anniversary of Russia's latest incursion into Ukraine is happening this week. Truman, I'm curious, did Army intelligence know how ineffective the Russian army would be, or maybe how effective the Ukrainian army was, or is this just a sort of shockingly new information for
them? Well, you know, of course, I'm 40 years out of the loop, but I can tell you that I was in Germany in August of 68 for the Czechoslovakian invasion, and I've talked about this before. I was in an intelligence unit, and we were completely shocked by the speed and the efficiency of the Soviet armor and army as it moved into Czechoslovakia. And in fact, I spent the rest of my time in Europe completely rewriting all of our manuals, about the capabilities and possibilities of the Soviets. So in terms of us being aware, I'm not so sure that we were, because we certainly weren't aware of what they were capable of at that time. So I don't know if our intelligence has gotten better. I would hope that it has, so that we would have a better idea. But I'm not sure that we did.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting in my mind. You know, we talk about, I'll use elections and polling as sort of an analogy that, pollsters have oftentimes been pretty inaccurate regarding election outcomes. And the true test is the election. Then you get the data. So, the true test is actual conflict, right? You can really see the capabilities of different military structures.
Well, and part of the issue too, though, is in Ukraine is the terrain and the infrastructure availability. In Europe, they had the Autobahn and they had the capability to roll, 4, 6, 8 lanes of tanks with road wheels on at doing 60 miles an hour. They did not have that opportunity in Ukraine, so it's a much different situation environmentally.
Sure. I saw this discussion just yesterday on, I don't know, CNN or something. They had a number of military experts, both diplomatic and actual generals or retired NATO generals, and they pretty uniformly agreed that that we, the Americans, underestimated the Ukrainians and overestimated the Russians.
I mean, I said at the beginning of this thing, when they were talking, before the invasion a year ago, I think Bruce Hallman asked me, well, what do you think is going to happen? And I said, it'll be over in a week. But that was based on what I had seen happen before. And I was absolutely shocked to see that it did not happen in a week. I mean, it amazes me still that it's still going on. So.
Yeah. James, what are your thoughts?
I think what everybody said is right. I think we underestimated the Ukrainians, but I think we underestimated the impact of culture and patriotism. And it's a weird analogy to make, but if we go back to World War II and the way the Russians fought during the deepest winter against the Germans when the Nazis were attacking, the Russians had the same sort of odds against them. And yet their culture, their pride led them to be successful. And I think the Ukrainians, that's a large part of it. I mean, we clearly hear them asking for more arms and armaments. They're a very small country compared to Russia. I almost wonder if we kind of took our eye off the ball with Russia globally, that there were other things that were attracting our attention. China, economic impact on the country, and worrying about Russia and Russian arms and armament wasn't as important to us for a while, and maybe we just blinked because they've just performed very poorly. And
I think that aggravated the situation. Putin felt like he was being left behind, becoming a third world country, and not the power that he was. He just wasn't getting the respect.
And I have to tell you, the equipment that the Russians are using were Soviet era equipment: T-54s, 55s, T-72 tanks. I think they had one new tank, a T-91, or 92. And I tell you, the T-54s and 55s and 72s, that's stuff I was working with, 40 years ago, for crying out loud. So I find that, that maybe they stalled. They didn't keep up.
Yes. So for those who know a little bit about the work that I did for 3 decades, we always warned ourselves about fighting the last war.
Yeah.
And be aware that we are conditioned to be prepared for the last bad thing that happened to us. And as you point out, Truman, those create our perspectives, and those can be dated. And how do we keep current with what the balance of strategic forces are with not only our allies, but our adversaries? Yep. And as the world becomes more challenging and potentially more dangerous, that becomes an ever more important equation for us to solve and to get right.
Absolutely.
So let's jump a little look ahead. Next week's small talk, we have another returning guest, Lennon Bronsema. Yeah, he actually wants to come back. So Lennon is now the vice president of campaigns at the newly renamed Washington Conservation Action. And given that we're just about halfway through the legislative session, Lennon's going to unveil his secrets of how the legislation, how the legislative session works. So we should learn a lot. So for Jessica, James, Bruce, Truman, and Craig, Bruce in absentia, we hope he comes back in another couple weeks. I'm Kevin Jones. Hope you'll join us next Tuesday for the next edition of the Brown Briefing.